A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
And now for a special edition of the New Statesman podcast, Stephen and I were joined by Andrew O'Hagan, writer of the LRB and of several books. Before we get to that though, just one quick reminder that Stephen and I are speaking at the King's Place Politics Festival at the weekend on Sunday at 4 p.m. if we haven't boiled to death by then, and tickets for that are still available, just have a Google. Hello, we're joined today by writer and journalist Andrew O'Hagan, who has a new book out which is called The Secret Life, which is based on three essays he originally wrote for the London Review of Books. The first is about his time as a ghostwriter for Julian Assange, whom will be familiar to listeners of this podcast. The second is about creating a fake identity for a man who died, leaving few traces. And the third is about a man who may or may not be Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin. Hello, Andrew. Thank you for joining
us. It's great to be here.
Well, actually, the day you've joined us today, Julian Assange has both announced and cancelled an appearance from his Evita balcony. So it's a very fitting day for you to be here.
It's very often the way. He seems to have a sort of eccentric relationship with his own diary. Whether he's going to appear on the balcony or not is something that keeps journalists busy, I think.
I know. It's a slight law of diminishing returns, though. There's just going to essentially, at the end, there'll be like one cat sitting outside. I wanted to talk to you about the book, first of all, and about what links these three stories. I mean, they are all stories in some ways about identity and about ghosting and about disappearance. What were the kind of kernels of them that attracted you to these stories?
I think even at the early stages, I knew that they might come together. I hoped that they would, because they seemed to me to draw on quite a similar energy from the times that we're living through, which is to do with a question about what's happening to selfhood, I would say, in the age of the internet. The old-fashioned sense, at least old-fashioned to me, part of my childhood was about trying to move steadily towards a sense of self that might be described as stable, at least identifiable, knowable, to yourself perhaps with any luck, and certainly to the people around you, that you'd have an identity that was just establishable. And however you changed, your core reality, to use a controversial word today, would remain there. I just don't think that's the same now. I speak as a novelist too, and we've always taken it for granted as novelists that the interior life and the shifts in internal life are the stuff of dramatic fiction. You know, changes and modulations in consciousness and selfhood are what we're all about, whether you're Henry James or Kafka. It's a common thread between them. But now I think that we shouldn't allow ourselves to rely too much on that notion of stability. I think what young people are often doing, I say this as a father of a 13-year-old who's addicted to some of these new opportunities that exist for not only self-invention, but self-manipulation and self-cancelling, all of which can happen on the net now. And I've watched it closely for quite a long time, and I saw it emerge in each of these stories in relation to one individual. Now, I don't think any of these individuals are particularly typical of the age. I mean, I don't think Assange is any more typical of the age than, you know, Charles Foster Kane is typical of the age of newspapers. I mean, he's a self-confection and he's atypical, in fact. But nevertheless, the three individuals in this book, I would argue, they represent something amongst themselves. I mean, together they begin to describe a sort of new territory, I think.
I think that's one of the things that comes across most strongly to me, is that you don't have I mean, I've been banging on about this for a long time, about this idea where you move from geographical communities primarily to kind of interest-based communities. And one of the things that changes is you don't have people to vouch for you anymore. You know, you're not the bank manager or, you know, the person at the Skittles Club. It becomes much harder to tell online who everybody, you know, that famous New Yorker cartoon about online, no one knows if I'm a dog. And that's quite liberating, but it's also incredibly destabilizing. I think the thing that really came across most strongly in the second of the two stories here, and the third one too, is you're kind of okay with the writer about not tying everything up with a neat little bow, and you kind of have to be to write about the internet.
I think, to be honest, Helen, that's really what allowed me to write these stories. I mean, I'm not particularly techie. I didn't, at least before setting out to write these stories, I had no particular inroads into the rather sort of narcissistic and baroque world of computer hacking and so on, or computer intelligence. It wasn't a world of mine, very naturally. But the one thing I had is the thing you name, which is, I wouldn't call it an ability, I'd call it a kind of predisposition to not want to tie everything up, to leave openness to do its magic. I think some writers are just like that, whether in journalism or in fiction, quite interested in the open-ended, in the dualistic, in the two-minded, in things neither being one thing or the other. I've always been interested in that. I mean, my first book was called The Missing, and it wasn't an accident that I chose that title and I followed those stories of missing persons who both existed and didn't exist, in a sense. It was a very different political culture then, and we can talk about changes in that. But certainly, it seemed to me that I had the right kind of madness for these people, I put it that way.
Yeah, because everybody in that Nakamoto story is kind of driven mad by the just, you know, it becomes the ultimate MacGuffin, right? That everybody just feels if only they can find this out, then suddenly they'll understand something really profound. And that reminds me, you know, that intense desire to find out who Elena Ferrante really was, as if that somehow will unlock, you'll know more about the novels because you know she's this, you know, Italian woman. I don't know why people get so hung up on that idea of closure.
I think it's a hysterical reaction now, a decade or more into this sense of the internet being so central in our lives. We're now getting a sort of hysteria around the place about people wanting almost to get back to old-fashioned, I know who you are, I know who you are, and I know who you are. I know your birth certificate, I know your parents, I know something about your DNA, and I can identify you. This hysteria about needing to identify people suddenly, because I think there's a fear, almost a primal fear now in our societies, that we're going to become so liquid that we don't know how to be a society. You mentioned before, I think absolutely rightly, that it's not geographically based in the way that it was. Therefore, what is it? Is it ideological? Is it gender-based? If we're living in a non-binary world in the future, and I increasingly hope we do, are we liquid to the extent that we don't actually have those anchors that hold us down? And for some people, that's called liberation, but other people, for others, it's called pure confusion, I think.
Most of revolutionary trends do tend to give way to a counter-revolution. You know, the Reformation, of course, had a period of Catholic revival, and sort of, yeah, I think it was interesting you used the word Baroque. Then obviously that was partly about the Catholic Church reasserting itself and its cultural origin. Do you think there will be a similar kind of identity counter-revolution to more sort of fixed forms of identity?
I think it's fascinating. I mean, I've never heard it put so straightforwardly, but yes is the answer from my perspective. I'm just one voice in this, of course, but having spent the best part of 6 years around this kind of miasma, I don't use that word as negatively as it might be used by others. I'm interested in the miasma. I'm interested in, as it were, the identityless generation, if it comes about. But I do think, in answer to your question, that there's already a revival, and in some quarters quite a right-wing revival, wanting community and nationalism and identity politics to be very clear. They want to know exactly who everybody is in the village. There's a danger in that. There's a fascistic tendency in that, in fact, as we know from history, that wanting to know who, not only who your neighbours are, but wanting to know everything there is to know about them. Well, that's a worry that's come with the technology and come with our circumstances. The relationship between MI5 and the CIA, especially recently over this business of fake off, to explain to listeners very briefly, we have brands of commercially available televisions now, many of them made by Samsung, which have a device in them which, when you switch them off, they go into a condition called fake off. They're still collecting data, and it was the intention of both the British and the American Secret Services to collect that data.
It's fascinating. I saw a picture of Mark Zuckerberg not long ago, and you know, he's got, you know, this guy who's Mr. Radical Openness, you know, I live my life in public, I'm going to do status updates about my dog and my wife and stuff like that. And he's got tape over his webcam and tape over his microphone on his laptop because he knows that it is really incredibly simple to hack those things.
As I do now, I mean, I wouldn't dream of, you know, sitting in front of a laptop now with a camera staring me in the face. Not that there's anything particularly interesting to look at in my study, I wish there was, but even my physog being looked at for the 5 or 6 hours of hard rictus face that it takes to get a paragraph out of me would be too much. But it's true, I mean, privacy is almost a suspect category now in a way that it never was. That was one of the subjects for me. I mean, Zuckerberg, in the early days of Facebook, expected people to announce their sexual persuasion, as it used to be called, thinking, well, if you don't want to reveal that, then it's because you're underhanded about it. But what if you just like your privacy?
Yeah, and he had real trouble in the early days, Facebook did, about the idea that people might get divorced or that they might die, right?
Yes.
That you might have life events might happen that you wouldn't want to say X is no longer married to Y, and it kind of pops up in everyone's newsfeed.
I mean, Zuckerberg, brilliant as he was, has always, I mean, up until now anyway, expressed what I think of as a young man's vision of freedom, and with the emphasis on man and young. You know, that it's not freedom as all of us would understand it. Gawker had the same attitude. I mean, they got excited every time there was an infringement of privacy. They thought privacy was a kind of ideological block in our society. It should be knocked out of the way. But that can lead to another place where everybody's being watched all the time. And any personal interaction, including the interaction between us in this room making a recording together, could be deemed suspect by somebody. You know, that's how you can go if you go too far into the let's know what everybody's doing all the time arena.
What I like about podcasts is you sort of forget that anyone's ever going to listen to them. Like, you just think, well, I'll get away with that. I said that on the podcast. But also, I do think that as a form, they're a really interesting thing because they are anti-viral, right? It's really hard to discover a podcast. It kind of happens in its own little space. It's actually quite hard to pick it up and kind of memeify it and pass bits of it on, which is a kind of a really refreshing thing. I mean,
it's wonderful that it actually might be possible to imagine a future where all real conversation happens by podcast, because every other kind, especially if it's happening in a sitting room with a television on fake off, isn't really private at all. I mean, this is at least declared broadcasting.
Yeah, the thing you mentioned there about the idea about the backlash, I think is awesome, because do you not think as well there might be, did you not find this exhausting? Because one of the things I've written a bit about internet trolls, and what becomes really exhausting is people leading you in a dance of, is this just my persona? Am I maybe? I'm just, you know, I'm telling you this, but am I telling you this? And do you thrive on that? Or did you sometimes just think, just tell me what you're thinking?
It's so interesting that, because, you know, it's the way, certainly as you describe it, it's the way in which this kind of work is most like writing fiction, because you never really know what the characters in the book that you're writing are saying to you. I mean, you might pretend you do, and you might, given that you invented them and gave them a face and a name and a backstory and a series of relationships, you're supposed to be some omniscient person, right? But actually, you're not. Not in my experience. You're waiting for the characters to have free will. And they exert it on you as you try to push them around the page. It becomes bad writing if you push them too hard. They've got to have some independent sort of scope in your mind. And I felt, in journalistic terms, these people were like that. They were always throwing roadblocks in front of me. They were always being inconsistent. And they were living a kind of pretend life very often. There was a whole day when Julian Assange pretended, very clearly, was a grown man pretending to find zip drives that he said material was on, that he'd worked on for the book. It was absolutely obvious to anybody that he had never done any work for the book and that these zip drives simply didn't exist. It told me a lot about his character, and it told me a lot about the desperate circumstances he found himself in. I put it into the story I eventually wrote much, much later. But it was an example for me of how the unpredictable, the obfuscating nature of some of these characters didn't put me off as a writer. It rather hooked me, in fact, in the way that sometimes friends can be more intriguing to you for not letting themselves quite go. It was a bit like that.
Yeah, I've just finished reading Selfie by Will Storr, which covers some of these issues as well about the idea of conceptions of the self. And one of the things that he brings out as well is the idea of a narcissistic culture and about people being unhappy because, exactly like Assange in that example there, or about Craig Wright, who does this thing of saying, hey, everybody, I'm Satoshi Nakamoto, and here's my proof. And then the proof turns out to be incredibly easily debunked. And he's kind of trapped in this kind of state of wanting, both wanting and not wanting to be it. But about people kind of creating a kind of carapace for themselves, which they then find is like a prison. You know, they feel that they have to kind of live up, even though they can tell that everybody's seeing through it, which I think is a fascinating thing.
I remember that wonderful thing of Orwell's about celebrity being a mask that eats into the face. And I think that whether it was celebrity or not, trying to step out of the shadow into some sort of recognised or some renown, you know, Craig Wright wanted all that. I mean, he courted all that. He brought me in in order to help him do that. As did the money guys behind him. Everybody was fully responding his wish to do it, as with Assange, you know, signing giant multi-million dollar book deals to write a book that actually he didn't want to write. These guys were courting celebrity, but then found that the mask that they actually had on was incredibly difficult to remove.
Obviously, you're a novelist as well as a journalist, and as you say, the kind of struggles of the interior life are, I think, probably key to most novels we care to name. Do you think the kind of way that we create identities for ourselves online, as that becomes more mainstream, will fundamentally change the kind of themes of the novel? I guess I'm thinking about kind of, you know, sort of Pride and Prejudice, the first great
English novel.
Are you
also thinking about
how
many bad novels there have been written about the internet?
Well, I think the interesting thing is I feel like no one has written a great novel about the internet.
The only two I think they've tried probably are Dave Eggers' The Circle and then the latest Jonathan Franzen that's got a Julian Assange-like character.
Both
in it,
of which I kind of thought
interesting
failed.
Failures.
Yeah.
I spoke to Jonathan Franzen about that book. I mean, he'd read the account I gave of my time with Assange over those months, and we spoke about it. He felt, I think, in some ways that Assange was a figure on the cusp between the old way of thinking about character and the new way, and maybe that's one of the things the novel doesn't quite resolve. But I think, in response to your question, it is the case that the novel has yet to produce, I mean, we've yet to have that absolutely all guns blazing, all whistles and bells. You know, a writer at the top of their form writing beautifully and deathlessly something that's set right within the centre of the internet. I think it's early days for that. In a way, though, I'm quite confident. In this, there was a moment, it's hard to believe now, I suppose, but there was a moment when sex hadn't really happened in the novel. Do you remember? I mean, it's before any of us, I'm happy to say, were born. But, you know, before Henry Miller or even Philip Roth, or I mean, D.H. Lawrence, I mean, there was sex in the sense that it was off the page, but its implications were everywhere. I mean, there's sex in Henry James, but... or George Eliot.
Yeah, but I guess Fanny Hill, yeah, no one managed to do sort of erotic fiction and remember to make it interesting fiction as
Well. Yeah, I mean, you know, there was always a big conundrum. How do you do sex, proper sex, where people get sweaty and people get regretful and people sort of, some people are happy and some people are not. Sometimes the people who are having sex together, you know, that kind of sex. And people said it will never really make it into the novel. It will destroy the novel. And I still wonder if it's properly made it into the novel. I mean, there's awards for writing badly about sex, although I've noticed there aren't awards for writing badly about sort of shopping or sleeping.
And the internet is the same thing, because the internet, again, is something that you... Well, I was going to say, this is like, a terrible sound. I was going to say the internet is something that you do on your own, but which I was thinking more about Philip Roth and masturbation, really, right, rather than sex, obviously.
You did get that onto the page, right?
But the internet is something that's kind of private, weirdly. It's a kind of... It's a sort of communion between you and a sort of nameless place. It actually... I think that's one of the reasons that maybe it's hard for the novel to deal with it, is that actually trying to kind of recreate and the strange kind of asynchronous of communication as well, the way that on WhatsApp you leave a message and someone picks it up.
It will need to be a very different novel. I mean, in that sense, it could revolutionise the novel. It will need the imagination, I think, of a new generation. I don't think anybody as old as I am, that's to say somebody in the late 40s, would really know how to get away from the eye contact obsession that somebody with my kind of background or credentials would have. I want to see people's face, ultimately. I mean, these stories I've written about the internet are based all on me looking into the eyes of somebody who might be at the centre of a notion of selfhood falling apart, but there is a flesh and blood person in front of me. And the flesh and blood element's always, if you like, at stake for me in these stories. Even with the middle story, which is about a boy who was invented by me, based on a guy who died in 1980, listeners may remember that the Metropolitan Police in London were doing this very thing for years. It was their way of infiltrating left-wing groups, was to steal the names of dead children from gravestones and build what they called a legend around them. And there's been things in the magazine about this over the years, but certainly it had taken on a form that had never really been properly described, because it was an ethical crime that had to be, in a sense, reproduced by an author who was willing to be ethically criminal.
Yes, I noticed some of the reviews said 5 stars for the writing, but 0 stars for the ethics, which yeah. was sort of, well, yeah, but, you know, that is kind of writing.
But actually, I wanted to ask you actually specifically about that type of review. How does that, some particularly of that more difficult second essay, make you feel?
Well, you know, I grew up believing that writers are actuality seekers. They go out there, you know, and they come back with the moral news, and if the moral news is bad, they still bring it. You know, you're a correspondent in a sense, and if you're a war correspondent, you don't come back from the front saying, you know what, not so nice. I think we'll just leave that one. I think we'll just leave Afghanistan because, you know, it's pretty horrible and it's actually politically so dodgy. And, you know, that's not your job. Your job is to come back with everything. And I think that's true of the society we live in. I always felt that what we needed more of in British journalism was foreign correspondents in our own country. We needed to send more people to, as it were, Newcastle or blocks of flats in West London and really describe the reality of what's going on there and how people are being treated there and how lives are being underestimated or defiled or made marginal. So that's foreign correspondents in your own country, in a sense. The way it makes me feel, if the story requires you to go in at a level which is mixing with the evil, you know, reproducing the bad element on the page and in the reporting, well, that's, to me, is one of your responsibilities. I mean, there will be squeamish people, including some squeamish reviewers, who say, well, a journalist should be a moral exemplar and that they should choose to lead morally. I've never thought of writers in that way.
I thought one of the most extraordinary things I've read this year is Andrew Solomon's Far From the Tree. I know I'm a bit behind the curve on this, which is about parents whose children have identities that are different from theirs. So he talks to the children of survivors of the Rwandan genocide, for example.
And the parents of the Columbine massacre.
Yeah, and one of the ones he talks to is parents of children with autism. And there's a line in there which is extraordinary, which is that lots of these kids, as they grow up and they go through puberty, they become sexually confused. And one of the couples has a son who is sexually aroused by nostrils. And he says, you know, sometimes my son just looks up my nostrils and starts masturbating. And you know what? Sometimes I'm so tired that I let him. Mm. And I remember that's just been an incredibly shocking thing to write. And I think if I'd been writing that story, I would have thought, should I put this in? You know, did that dad really mean to tell me that? Should I protect him? But equally, well, it's just, it belonged in there because it's so true, right? It's something that you instantly recognise that, yes, actually you can totally see why people, you know, and the honesty of that is extraordinary, what you should be aiming for in journalism.
I think so, absolutely, 100%. You know, if there were people who used to say to Seymour Hirsch at the time of my lie, don't put that in. In fact, don't put it in, don't put any of it in, because it, in some senses, endangers our national security, it hands it to the enemy, it gives the ideological victory to our opponents. It's frightening, it will keep people up at night. I mean, there are 1,000 reasons why not to publish, but there are always 1 or 2 absolutely sterling reasons to ignore that and go ahead and publish, and that is that it's happening in the world and it has, as it were, moral dimension that's going to affect all of our lives, so a writer should get in there and do it. Whether they get brownie points for being the most moral person in the class or not, well, that's for the birds as far as I'm concerned.
But that must be easy for you because you're not, as far as I can see, ironically, very much on the internet.
No, I'm not. I've never been. In fact, I've never had a passionate relationship with social media of any kind. That's not to say I oppose it in any way. I mean, I think that I oppose the attempt to mistake it for literature. I mean, 140 characters you can do quite a lot with, but it's not Tolstoy. It's not War and Peace, that's to say. Neither does it pretend to be in most cases, so fair enough, you know. But I sometimes worry that people who question the nature of social media and what it's doing to our relationships and our sense of society are thought to be these sort of, you know, conservatives who hate the idea of the technology. I love the idea of the technology. Some of these stories I've written, not only could they not have been written because the subjects were in that world, but also the internet was enormously helpful to me in dealing with these people. We were on the net all the time. There was never a moment you know, when I was with Assange in that house in Norfolk, when we went all online and dealing with, you know, his capacity to make a difference on there.
Yeah, I think it's the other way around. I think, you know, I'm on Twitter, but I kind of hate myself on Twitter, right? Mm. I think actually if I wasn't on it, I'd probably have a better relationship with it because I'd see it from the outside rather than as seeing it like something that I'm mildly addicted to and I wish that I wasn't.
It's quite a defensive world, the world of tweeting, because people, you know, both, as you say, you describe it honestly, you know, the sort of loving and loathing aspect of it. But a lot of people who are on it quite dedicatedly sort of are in a constant state of rage against people who aren't, as if the people who aren't are trying to sort of forge a private life that is bogus and unearned and undeserved. And that's where I balance my interest in a way. I'm interested in this growing sense that privacy is a form of underhandedness. And I think the consequences of that could be massive, especially politically.
I think it definitely reinforces the status quo. There was a good book review we had a while ago that talked about noise and about silence and saying, you know, silence is a class issue, right? Because if you are rich, you can buy yourself a house that is away from everyone else. You can soundproof your windows. You know, you have a front door. If you're poor and you live on an estate, you have people banging past your door all the night. And actually something as simple as that. And I think privacy is the same. You can buy yourself an awful lot of privacy.
You're absolutely
with money.
Right about that, by the way. And, you know, less than 100 years ago, it was Virginia Woolf's great argument about women, was a room of your own, a room of one's own. It was about not being trapped inside this machine where everybody else made a noise and had claims on you, so they thought. You know, a room of one's own is a place where you could go and close the door.
Yeah.
And that closing the door, whether it's to achieve the silence or just, as it were, the self-empowerment that comes with having your furniture arranged as you want it and walking in whatever style or direction you want to in your room. I think it's a bit like that with the net. You know, it's very good for people who want to display themselves, but I'm interested in people who are less ample when it comes to wanting to display. I quite like the things that go on one-to-one. I'm rather protective of them.
And just as we're running out of time, one last thing. Where is the most fascinating place on the internet to you?
Oh, the most fascinating place on the internet to me is Instagram, because my daughter is a great fan of it and has made me a great fan of it. And so I find myself, you know, when I probably should be sort of, you know, attacking some piece of work, the thumb goes out and sort of gently sort of finds its way to, you know, see what she's posting now. So for sentimental reasons mainly, it's my favourite place on the net.
It's a gentler place, isn't it? It's a place of dogs and breakfasts. And that's
dogs and breakfasts and people having a life that you otherwise wouldn't see. And for those of us who never use the phone enough and don't see your friends enough, it's just a lovely way. It's an actual addition to life. It's a lovely way of having a life in correspondence with other people constantly without having to have them right there in front of you.
Thank you very much for joining us. The book is The Secret Life and it is out now. This special edition of the New Statesman podcast was brought to you by me, Helen Lewis.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
And my co-host, Stephen Bush. It was produced and mixed by a hero, India Burke, who sits and listens to us waffle on all of the time, for which we thank her.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.